We're exploring 100 parks, including 63 national parks, a testament to the unique and amazing landscapes across our country. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for joining us. Travel and science writer Stephanie Pearson is our guide. She writes that we have a responsibility to educate ourselves about the past and to be better stewards of the land and to each other. Join in on national parks, the ones you've wondered about, those you've explored, what captivated you in those awesome vistas. 800-642-1234. Stephanie Pearson, contributing editor to Outside Magazine, author of 100 Great American Parks, published by National Geographic. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So I was distracted by the gorgeous photography in the book, which is understandable. Uh-huh. And when I read your first words in the book and the word Duluth comes up, like it didn't even connect in my brain. I didn't think like, that's our Duluth, like Duluth, Duluth. my brain was just somewhere else in these gorgeous, you know, national parks that we think about our icons. So I want to ask you about your centeredness and placemaking. What did you appreciate growing up around Hartley Park and Duluth?
Well, I grew up in Duluth. My dad's family immigrated here from Sweden to various parts of northern Minnesota. So it really was home. And we lived on this dead end street up in the Hunters Park neighborhood, if you're familiar with that. And Hartley Park was this farm that had been tax forfeited, and we lived on the street that connected to it. So there were incredible cross country ski trails there. And we had these sledding hills and this, you know, our own little promontory that looked over the lake. And it was really not very crowded when I was growing up. And it's since become a very beautifully manicured park with a lot of infrastructure in it. So I feel like I was in the stage where it was just sort of becoming what it is today. And it was just a great way to grow up.
It had a lot of impact on you because you grew up becoming a travel and science outdoor writer and editor.
Yeah, Duluth really did have an impact on me in that regard.
So your book identifies 100 notable parks in the country. And most of these are national parks, the ones that really, you know, we call to mind. But some of them are, you know, state city parks like, you know, Theodore Worth Park, where I did a ton of cross-country skiing in my youth. How did you determine what makes a great park for this book?
Well, I had a mandate. It's an interesting story. The book started out as a book about international parks, and then the pandemic hit. It was assigned to me January 2020 and as an international parks book. And then over the course of months, it changed to domestic parks. And the one mandate that the editors had was that it needed to include the 63 national parks. But then I was able to choose the 37 remaining parks. And I wanted to put a park in each state, district, territory. And then I just had some favorites that I wanted to include. And I also wanted to include some non-traditional parks, like wilderness areas that are in no way parks, but they are really important to the formation of public land in our country. They sort of make up this tapestry of the public land that we have.
I'm thinking there of Gila Wilderness in New Mexico, which is very much connected to Aldo Leopold. I didn't realize that, who proposed that this beautiful landscape should be set aside. Can you kind of explain a little bit about the Wisconsin connection there to Gila Wilderness?
Well, Aldo Leopold is a Wisconsin man. He sort of developed his land ethic in Wisconsin. I think he was actually born in Iowa, but he spent numerous years in Wisconsin, and he wrote Sand County Almanac based on his life there. And then he was a ranger also in New Mexico and Arizona. And in the land ethic is really just the fact that humans, you know, each person must be a steward of the land, and humans need to integrate themselves into the pyramid of life rather than attempt to control it. And so his big idea with the Gila was that he wanted to set that land aside and not create a park, just leave it as intact wilderness. And the really interesting thing about the Gila is that it's been inhabited for thousands of years by the Mogollon people and various others. And so there are a lot of ruins in the Gila and just a lot of amazing wolf stories. And, you know, it's a place where they're constantly trying to, you know, maintain the wolf population, and its mountains and important river systems. And it's really just a huge, massive stretch of land in southwestern New Mexico that he was instrumental in preserving. And it was the first wilderness area in the country.
I'm going to reintroduce you here as we talk about great American parks with journalist Stephanie Pearson. Tell us about your favorite park. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Stephanie, I mean, you've been all over the world as a journalist, travel writer. What U.S. national parks are most significant to you? What did you care deeply about to try to convey in this project?
Oh, it sort of brings tears to my eyes, actually. I get really emotional about these places. I think that the first thing that really struck me in doing this book, it was like a college history course in, you know, public lands. And these places we tend to think of as landscapes, you know, where you can get a good view of something. But really, there's so much more history in these parks, and they're chosen very deliberately for what segment of history they represent in the U.S. And one of the parks that I have not visited, that's a newer park, it's the Harriet Tubman National Historic, or Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad National Historic Park. And it's in Maryland, and it's in the marshes where she grew up working in the marshes, doing very heavy labor. And this whole park, this whole building is oriented north to where she wanted to go her whole life. And it tells the story of her enslaved life. And it's got some pretty incredible elements to it. And that's a place I haven't been yet that has some meaning. But there are many others as well.
Sure. And, you know, these parks too, as you mentioned, are preserving historical events, but also conserving the environment. There are a lot of tensions that go on there too. Native American people, indigenous people being forced from that land that the federal government is still trying to protect. And I'm just wondering, how do you see those balances taking shape through national parks? What areas do you set aside for visitors, and what areas have you pushed people off the land so that you can, you know, bring others in to see it?
Yeah, that's the sort of the push and pull of the National Park Service. I mean, it is this incredible conservation story and has been a model for the rest of the world. But, you know, for example, in 1872, when Yellowstone was established by Congress, you know, they didn't really want I think it's 27 indigenous groups that are associated with Yellowstone. They didn't want that presence in Yellowstone because they were afraid that it would, you know, scare away the tourists. And so that's something that has gone throughout history. And it's something now with, you know, our Interior Secretary and Chuck Sams at the National Park Service, they're really trying to reintegrate the Native story and, you know, sort of get back some of that ownership, not physical ownership, but just, you know, investment in that, in these places.
Stephanie Pearson, exploring her new book from National Geographic, 100 Great American Parks. Join in on stunning park destinations that have changed you, gems around the country, a bucket list national park adventure that you want to do research on. Pick Stephanie's brain about 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, back in a minute with Stephanie Pearson here on the Ideas Network. We're appreciating America's parks on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One of my favorite lines in travel writer Stephanie Pearson's book is that there's no better place than the Grand Canyon to make one feel like a speck of dust in the continuum of the universe. Have you ever felt that way when visiting a national wonder so small? So small. Join in 800-642-1234. It's National Geographic's 100 Great American Parks. Stephanie Pearson with us for the hour. Let's take a call now. Mark is joining us from Eau Claire. Mark, hi. What you want to bring up the Grand Canyon?
Hi, good morning. I'd like to first start off by saying that I was very thrilled to hear about Hartley Park. My great-grandfather, Guilford Graham Hartley, had that piece of land to raise lettuce on back in the early 1900s.
Wow.
But I wanted to say that we just visited Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, Zion, Bryce, and Yosemite this spring and early summer. And with all the beautiful rocks that there are and the scenic vistas, the hotels are what really struck us. The El Tovar Hotel in Grand Canyon, the Awani Hotel in Yosemite, even the Zion Hotel, even though it's a little more modest, in Zion National Park, were really structures that if you go to the parks, you really should try and stay at. The ambiance is just back to the early 1900s.
Oh, wow. Mark, you have so much to offer here. Where are you heading next? What is the next park?
You know, I wanted to go to Isle Royale, which I don't know if that's featured in your book, but Isle Royale National Park.
Yes, it is.
Isle Royale National Park is so little used, and it's really so much of a iconic wilderness area in the middle of Lake Superior.
Mm. Well, Mark, Stephanie, there's so much to unpack here with Mark. I don't know where you're going to begin, but just go.
Well, first of all, Mark, it's a pleasure and an honor to meet you. And I thank you, your family for what they had to offer Duluth. It's incredible. Really nice to meet you. And I agree. I think the hotels, I remember I was in Yellowstone National Park on an assignment about 10 years ago. And I was waiting for the geyser to go off like many other people. And I wandered over to the hotel, the famous hotel, the one that has all of the levels and just incredible woodwork inside. And I think I missed the geyser going off. So, so I agree. The architecture in these buildings is incredible. And as for Isle Royale, I highly recommend it. That's a place that it just feels so far away, namely because you either have to take a ferry or a float plane to get there, but it's worth the journey. And it's just I think I saw three moose on one hike. So I hope you can get there very soon.
You called it like a time machine to a simpler era. Do you really feel transported, like you're just very alone out there?
You do, because one of the interesting things is that like a lot of the, well, like the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore, there has been such a human presence there. I mean, there mm-hmm. are some lighthouses and there are some old cabins, and these cabins have been in the same state for the last few decades at least, and mm-hmm. there's really a big fishing culture, and so you really feel like you're entering this different era, especially as you come from the Minnesota side, because there's not a lot of infrastructure. There's in fact very little infrastructure on the west side of the island, and so and then your boat leaves in the early morning in the fog, and you feel like you're just venturing out into this massive body of water, and it's really an exciting journey.
Going back to Isle Royale for a moment, you know, when you are venturing into a remote wilderness, or you know, regardless of whether it's there or somewhere else, what should you bear in mind to make it a really good experience? But you're also in a very remote area.
I think first of all, you really need to do your homework. I mean, like anywhere, Isle Royale is very remote, and if something were to happen out there, it would be a difficult, I mean, you could probably get an emergency evacuation via helicopter that I think the only helicopters that service Lake Superior come from Michigan, I believe. So, mm-hmm. So it is pretty remote, but I think you just need to do your research and be prepared and make sure somebody knows where you are and know the kinds of terrain you're going to be traveling in. Of course, you know, Isle Royale is a very, you know, it's in a cold place, even in the summer. So bring ample layers and clothing and just be prepared.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I want to go back to Mark for a moment, because some of these national parks you visited, Mark, are all in the book. And I'm wondering, how do you decide what national park to visit?
You know, when we looked at the national parks, and I've been to a number of them, like Gettysburg and others, one of the things that we wanted to do is we wanted to stay at these iconic historic hotels, because the architecture and the feel of the hotel adds so much to the national park. And they were absolutely beautiful. Old Faithful Inn at Yellowstone was really not to be believed, as the Ahwahnee Hotel in the El Tovar in California and in the Grand Canyon. These hotels were built in the 1920s and are constructed out of native materials from around the area, and really are such a beautiful type of natural architecture with so much that went into the thought process by the designers and the builders.
Mm. I can tell, Mark, you've really found your travel sweet spot. You know what you love to do. So I really credit you for that, because it sounds like you've done that homework and you really have found some really great experiences.
One of the things that I would also emphasize is that when you're going to a national park, like your guest said, do your homework. Go and look at the national park websites and download the things that they say. They're very, very complete, and they give you ideas of where to hike depending upon your level of strenuousness.
Mm-hmm.
And to look at different points of interest. I would say that of the big rock parks that we were at, which I say that the Yosemite, the Big Ditch, or the Grand Canyon,
yes,
the most beautiful rocks that I found were in Bryce Canyon.
Mm.
And Bryce Canyon's rocks were just stunning, big red columns. They're just beautiful. But there are natural areas that are closer to home, where you don't have to, you know, go to a national park and stay and all that. Like by Spearfish or by Rapid City, the Needles Highway is really quite beautiful.
Mm. Well, Mark, you've given us just a wealth of things to think about. Stephanie, I want to ask you about, park attendance, because there's been such a surge in popularity. Mark has really found that research helps, but how do you make sure that you're not just trying to, you know, get around throngs of people?
All right. Yeah, I think, I actually just wrote a story about this for Outside Magazine that will be in the next issue, the one that's just coming out. But the parks are really aware of this. And COVID really, really bumped up park visitation around the country. And for example, I think the most basic thing is try to go in the off season, you know, try to go on those shoulder seasons. Like, for example, my sister's family just went to Bryce, as Mark did, and they did it in early April or mid-April, and that's right before it gets to be the busy season. And they really didn't have the crowd issues that many people experience in these really popular parks. Zion, for example, gets 5 million visitors now per year. They've just reached that goal. But at Zion, they're actually building a whole new east entrance, and they've spent years designing it so that it doesn't impact the view shed. And it's really a collaboration between the state and federal and county governments, so that they're doing it in the best possible way, which is to hope to mitigate the flow into that really popular park. So they are aware of it, but for individuals, I just say, like Mark said, do your research, try to go in the off season if you can, and just try to be respectful of the rules too, I would say.
Stephanie Pearson, 100 Great American Parks, discovering the beauty, the mini parks that our country has to offer. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the new illustrated collection from National Geographic, 100 Great American Parks, on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Recording artist Garth Brooks writes in the foreword, "The story of America lives in the land, and most people have barely scratched the surface when it comes to all America has to show. Join in on the parks of America that moved you, breathtaking views that you hope to see again, tips on visiting parks, ones that you're curious about, 800-642-1234. Travel outside writer and author Stephanie Pearson with us for the hour. Let's take another call now. Jeff is joining us from Superior, so in Stephanie's neck of the woods. Jeff, hi, go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to share two things. I like to hike the high points in each state, and I've got about 22 of them down so far. And that takes you out of the way, sometimes into great parks and sometimes literally into a parking lot behind a water treatment center somewhere, because it's the highest naturally occurring point. But a previous caller had said, talked about the Grand Canyon. And I just wanted to offer a tip that I experienced with the Grand Canyon, which is, if you've never been there before, you should go there and get there before sunrise, because your brain really can't process just how big and how vast it is. And then what happens as the sun comes up is you just keep on thinking, oh, well, that must be it. That's just how big it is. And it just keeps on getting bigger and bigger as the sunlight reveals the next bend and the next, part of the valley that you just haven't seen yet. Until finally, then you're like, wow, that's it. This is amazing. But you can only have the experience once, because once you've been there before, you kind of have an idea in your head of what it's going to be like.
Sure.
It's still an amazing experience again, but that first time really should be, get there before sunrise.
I mean, get there in the dark, get set, and then just watch this natural movie, I guess, unfold in your eyes as the sun comes up. That's what it sounds like, Jeff.
Yep.
Oh, wow. Stephanie, what do you make of that tip?
Well, I think it's a great tip. And I'm curious, Jeff, if you would unveil where you like to watch the sunrise from the Grand Canyon National Park. Is there a particular campsite or spot?
I was only there one time, and I'm not, it was, I mean, I came from kind of the south, on the freeway there. And so I don't remember offhand exactly which spot it was, other than it was just kind of I was helping a friend move across country. So we were driving across country in a moving truck, but made a special trip to stop at the Grand Canyon, because we knew we weren't going to have another, well, we may have another chance, but certainly together we might not have another chance.
Oh, I love that story. Stephanie, isn't it really neat too about how just, people have to make time for these incredible moments to see these places.
And Jeff, you bring up a great point. I think that there are so many. One other, the Petrified Forest, it's off I-40. And if you've ever traveled on I-40, as you probably have, if you pass the Grand Canyon, it's just a freeway of semi-trucks and cars going fast across the country. But there are a lot of incredible parks off of it, like the Grand Canyon, as well as Petrified Forest. And these places are amazing. And you have no sense of where or what they will be until you take that brown sign exit off the freeway. And so I admire you for taking time out of your move to do that, because that's a stressful time.
And Jeff, why the highest points in each state?
It just started off almost exactly like your guest there said, that just seeing a high point marker. I was actually traveling to the Badlands in Black Hills with a college roommate who was a geology major, and we were driving through Iowa, and there was a high point marker sign up on the highway, and I said, "Have you ever been to a high point?" He said, "No." I said, "Well, you're a geology major. You got to see one of these things. I don't even know what they are, but you're the geology major," and so. So we pulled off, and the high point in Iowa literally is a marker in somebody's cornfield in parking lot. And then we looked at our campsite in South Dakota in the Black Hills and realized we were literally a few miles away from the trailhead for what was then Harney Peak and is now Black Elk Peak. So we hiked that one, and that was actually a very challenging and very rewarding hike. Not very challenging in that it was, you know, really difficult for average people, but it was, you know, it was a respectable hike.
I would imagine you've checked Tim's Hill off your list.
Tim's Hill is about as exciting as the name sounds. The water, the fire tower there.
Okay, we should. Wisconsin's highest point.
Yeah. Eagle Mountain as well in Minnesota is a great, and that one has great views in the fall. And my most recent one, my most recent challenging hike was Mount Katahdin in Maine. And then also the Cog Railway is the only in New Hampshire is the only high point where you can ride to the top of a mountain in a steam train. Those are just amazing, fun experiences there.
Wow. And you really get, you know, Stephanie, like Jeff really gets the range from pulling off, you know, maybe yes. into a cornfield versus, you know, some of these more regal high points.
Well, and the other thing I like about that, Jeff, is that these are not all of the iconic destinations. You know, they're creating this really cool adventure for you, but they may not, you know, be the most iconic destination in each state or something, which is great.
Yeah, it takes you off the beaten path, and it gets you to see a side of America that you probably didn't know you were looking for.
And yeah. It gives you stories to tell.
Yeah.
Oh, Jeff, thank you so much for calling in as we talk with Stephanie Pearson, author of 100 Great American Parks. You can join in on your favorite parks, your tips, parks you're researching now or you want to know more about, 800-642-1234. Just going back really quickly, Stephanie, to Grand Canyon. I mean, I think you had the statistic that fewer than 1% of people who visit go to the bottom of the canyon. You know, I would imagine that the people who make it as their destination and not, you know, just kind of like pulling over because they're going by would want to hike it. But what would you say there about hiking the Grand Canyon?
Well, hiking the Grand Canyon is a challenge because it's an inverse challenge. I think people go down and they think, oh, this isn't so bad. And but then they have to go up. And they generally might have to go up in a hotter time of day. And it's a really, really difficult hike back up. You know, and on the other hand, there are, you know, ultra runners and you know, cyclists who are carrying their bikes up these, you know, they're doing it in the fastest known time. I don't know what the fastest known time is. So I think as time goes on, more and more people are using that challenge in different ways. But I think the real challenge of it is the heat, the lack of water, and the fact that you're going down first, which is a little misleading.
Or a lot misleading, because as you said, I mean, that return up is going to be at a hotter time of day, and it's going to be much more intense and grueling.
Yes, true.
Wow. Okay. I want to move on to some urban parks in your book. You point out like Grant Park in Chicago, and then there's Central Park and Boston Common. What makes a really great urban park?
Well, I think it's interesting because the urban parks in this book all represented something a little different to me. Central Park I just chose because honestly, the rare times that I'm in New York City, I try to stay as close to Central Park as I possibly can, just because I need that green space in my life. Mm. And I am continually fascinated by how much diversity that park offers, and how many people use it as their sense of sanity. And it's just a beautiful place. I mean, it's a really, really beautiful green space. And Boston Common, it just has such historical resonance in our country. It's really the first, park in the United States, which has been used in many different ways over the course of, you know, centuries. And so that one was interesting to me for that reason. And Chicago Grant Park, again, there have been a lot of really important moments in Grant Park. The Democratic Convention, I think there was some in 68, there was some rioting there, and just a lot of unrest, which, you know, a lot of times you think of these parks as these really peaceful places, but oftentimes they're places to protest as well, which is really, I think, interesting. And the same happened at Boston Common too. But then also, like, Michael Jordan and the Bulls had their big celebrations in Grant Park. And then Barack Obama had his acceptance speech and these are big historical moments. The first Black president of the United States, you know, that's where he chose to have his acceptance speech. And so not only for what they provide to the city, but also sort of this historical lens, I find really interesting.
Author Stephanie Pearson is leading us through 100 Great American Parks, published by National Geographic. Still time to join in on national treasures, parks you're wondering about all over the country, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more with Stephanie Pearson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Stephanie Pearson, 100 Great American Parks. And I want to give a shout out to Atchafalaya National Heritage Area in Louisiana, one of the awesome sites profiled in this book. The cypress swamps, you can't take enough pictures because the light and the texture on the cypress trees is just reflecting off the water. It's magical. It's so haunting. Join in 800-642-1234. Stephanie Pearson wrote the new book from National Geographic, 100 Great American Parks, with us for about 10 more minutes. Stephanie, pull back the curtain a bit. How do photos get chosen in books like this?
Well, it's a mysterious alchemy. You know, it's all National Geographic. I mean, they have such a depth of photography. They pull it from their archives. I mean, so the book process, you write an outline that sort of highlights what you're going to cover and maybe some highlights of it. And then through the process, they just, you know, pull photos that they think really represent what these places represent. And yeah, I have to say, I was absolutely thrilled when I saw the first, you know, copy of this book, because I hadn't seen it with photos.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine you would be like, well, my words are going to be dwarfed by these images.
Yeah. And that's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. You know, it's such a thrill to see these places come alive through these photos. And, I love all of them.
Let's take another call. Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
What would you like to bring up? Hi.
Well, I just wanted to mention, ask if your guest has looked into the growing tendency to invite visitors to the park to participate in restoration efforts in the park as a way of participating in the ecology and engaging the history of the park. And that I think has been going on for some time, and I thought you might have some comments about that.
Oh, Bill, thank you. Giving back while you're there. Stephanie?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. In fact, I just ran across a press release somebody sent to me a day or two ago about grants that are being given to these postdoctoral students who can go into the parks, and they're given a certain amount of money to enhance the historical storytelling or some conservation aspect of it. But you're absolutely right. I think these are public places. They're federally funded, but they are really owned by the public, and we all need to participate in that. And one example of what you're talking about, which I thought was really cool, was at Acadia National Park a couple of years ago. They had an anniversary celebration, and I can't remember which anniversary it was. And Acadia is one of the more popular parks in the country. They get
in
many
Maine.
Visitors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in Maine. And so for this celebration, the park reached out to the local communities and said, you know, we can't really have more impact in the park, but can you celebrate this park within your communities that people can come who love this park and feel celebratory, but it doesn't put more impact on the park? And it actually was a great success. And so these communities sort of took ownership of this celebration, and it happened all around the park, but not necessarily in the park. But also, I think there is a lot of physical labor that you can sign up to do. It depends on which park and how, you know, how they like to process that in terms of their volunteer. I mean, I think there are sometimes liability issues and things like that, but I think that's a great, great suggestion. And, you know, if you're planning a trip, you know, plan a day or two to see what you can do to give back to these places.
It also calls to mind that I learned in your book about the two-sentence Yellowstone Pledge. Can you describe what that is?
Yeah, that's a lot of parks have that. And, you know, it's nothing formal. It's not like you put your hand on a, you know, park book and pledge to a ranger or anything. I mean, it's really just a guideline of how you are going to act in the park. You know, and if you, the first one is give wildlife room, use a Zoom. So there's 10, you know, there's 10 parts of this pledge. And it's sort of funny because every day this summer, I think I've heard about somebody who's been charged by a bison or a bear in Yellowstone. And so this pledge is really, people are just taking the time to think about their actions within this park. I mean, you know, follow the beaten path, be bear aware, watch out for water. You know, I mean, Yellowstone just flooded horrifically.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, practice safe selfies. So, you know, just really things that are very basic, but sometimes people get so excited that they don't necessarily follow those basic instructions.
Let's go to Becky now in Houstisford. Becky, hi.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. Just a few other wonderful parks I wanted to give a shout out for. In Philadelphia, the Independence Hall, Liberty Bell, and the whole historic district there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marvel to see where some of the most momentous occasions in American history took place, and how extraordinarily small some of the buildings were.
Mm-hmm.
Also places like the Great Smoky Mountains that has also the Appalachian Trail running through it, which is a wonderful hike. Boundary Waters in northern Minnesota, which then transitions on the other side of the boundary to Quetico Provincial Park. And then way down at the other corner, Everglades National Park, a river of grass that is amazing, absolutely amazing.
Oh, Becky.
And I could go on, but
yes.
I'll just mention those.
I love the top ones there on your list. Stephanie, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, these are great. And they're all very diverse. You know, Great Smoky Philadelphia, I did not include that in my book, but I admit that I am a little, Civil War history is not my strong point, but there are some incredible, incredible places in, you know, Virginia and that, mm-hmm. that focus on that period of our, well, civil and pre-civil war. But Great Smoky Mountains National Park, that's in the book. And that's, I think that is the perhaps most populated national park or most visited national park in the country. I think it gets like 4 million visitors per year. And it's, you know, it's a gorgeous place. Yeah, the Boundary Waters. I actually worked up in the Boundary Waters.
I was going to say, that's really close to home.
So I guided canoe trips, so I know that and love that. And that's in the book. And that's one of those, you know, wilderness areas that, you know, is not a real park, but it, you know, people can use it. And it's, I think it is one of the most visited wilderness areas in the country. Yeah, in the Everglades, you know, it's got incredible wildlife diversity, mm-hmm. American alligator and crocodile, which is the only place in the world you'll find both. And just a lot of bird diversity. And it's a place I would like to spend more time.
Oh, well, we've been all over the place here. Are there any overlooked parks that you wanted to bring up?
Oh my gosh. I think any park, I mean, there are so many. I think one, you know, there's, that's a tough question. Channel Islands, I think in California, off the coast of California, is a really interesting place for a lot of reasons, evolutionary reasons and human history reasons. They're sort of developing new theories on how people came down the coast, the Pacific coast. They think now, because of what they found in the Channel Islands, people might have used the waterways instead of the land to get mm-hmm. as far south as where the Channel Islands are now. So there, that's, I guess, another thing about these parks. A lot of research and science is being done in these parks that is constantly evolving, which is really exciting. There's a bunch. I don't know.
Where are you going to next, may I ask?
Well, I love to spend my summers in Minnesota because it's the best place to be in the summer, I think, and Wisconsin. But I'm planning to go on a bike packing trip to Utah, which will sort of skirt a lot of the Utah national parks later in September.
Oh.
And yeah, so that's my next adventure.
Oh, Stephanie, this has been so fun. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Happy trails to you.
And to you.
Thank you. Stephanie Pearson, journalist, contributing editor to Outside Magazine, author of 100 Great American Parks, published by National Geographic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.